In this segment of the program, we're going to discuss how people learn. We'll be focusing on perceptions, insights, and motivation. Now, initially, all learning comes from perceptions, which are directed to the brain by one or more of the five senses, you know, the sight, hearing, touch, smell, and taste. Now, psychologists have determined through experiments that normal individuals acquire about 75% of their knowledge through their sense of sight, 13% through hearing, 6% through touch, 3% through smell, and the other 3% through taste. They have also found that learning occurs most rapidly when information is received through more than one sense. Now, that is very important to remember. Let me repeat it. Learning occurs most rapidly when information is received through more than one sense. Perceiving involves more than the reception of stimuli from the five senses. Perceptions result when a person gives meaning to sensations. That is worth repeating. Perceptions result when a person gives meaning to sensations. People base their actions on the way they believe things to be. Now, real meanings come only from within a person, even though the sensation which evoke these meanings result from external stimuli. Now, because the meaning which is derived from the information furnished by the senses may depend on many factors within each person concerned, and because perceptions are the basis of all learning, a knowledge of the factors which affect the perceptual process is very important to the instructor. So, let's take some time to discuss this further. Factors which affect perception. Among the factors which affect an individual's ability to perceive are that person's, number one, physical organism, number two, their basic need, number three, goals and values, number four, self-concept, number five, time and opportunity, and number six, recognition of the element of threat. So let's take each one of these topics and elaborate on them. The physical organism is very simple. It's basically you. It's the vehicle by which individuals become aware of or operate in the world of which they're a part. The second factor that affected our perception was a basic need. See, a person's basic need is to maintain and enhance the organized self. The self is complete. It is a person's past, present, and future combined. It is both physical and psychological. See, a person's most fundamental pressing need is to preserve and perpetuate this self. All perceptions are affected by this need. Good point to remember. Now, just as the food one eats and the air one breathes becomes the physical self, so do the sights one sees and the sounds one hears becomes the psychological self. See, psychologically, we really are what we perceive. A person has physical barriers which keep out those things that would be damaging to the physical being, such as, you know, maybe blinking when you see an arc weld or not looking directly at the sun or maybe flinching from a hot iron. So likewise, a person has perceptual barriers that block those insights, those sounds and feelings which pose a psychological threat to them. Now, helping people learn then requires finding ways to aid them in developing better perceptions in spite of their defense mechanisms. Since a person's basic need is to maintain and enhance the self, the instructor or teacher must recognize that anything that is asked of the student, which may be interpreted by the student as imperiling his self, will be resisted or denied. To teach effectively, it is necessary to work with that knowledge. Now, the next thing, let's go over goals and values. Perceptions depend really on one's goals and values. Every experience and sensation which is funneled into one's central nervous system is colored by the individual's own beliefs and value structures. For example, spectators at a ball game may see an infraction or foul differently depending on which team they support. You've seen that before. You ever watch two people watch a football game? Something happens and the person says, oh no, he's in. And the other person says, oh no, he's out. Back and forth. That's based on their perception. The precise kinds of commitments and physiological outlooks which the student holds are important for the instructor to know, since this knowledge will assist in predicting how the student will interpret experiences and instructions. Motivations are also a product of one's value structure. Those things which are more highly valued and cherished are pursued. Those which are accorded less value and importance are not sought after. An additional point here you might want to keep in mind is that we do everything in life for two reasons only. One, because we have to, or the second, because we want to. Motivations are one of the most important factors in learning. They are affected by many other factors also, and we'll be discussing some of those in detail later on in the program. Well, the next thing that we want to talk about is self-concept. How one pictures oneself is a most powerful determinant in learning. See, a student's self-image, described in such terms as confident or insecure, has a great influence on the total perceptual process. If a student's experience tends to support a favorable self-image, the student tends to remain receptive to subsequent experiences. If a learner has negative experiences which tend to contradict self-concept, then there's a tendency to reject additional training. This area of self-concept really is very interesting. Let me share with you some examples. When I go through the hiring process, one of the first things I tell people is that as a company, we really strive to be the best. We work hard to go beyond excellence, and we're always pushing the bar higher and higher. Then I ask them the following question. Are you that type of person? Well, they all say yes. Why? Well, they want the job, right? But here is what's happened in the past. As I'm training someone in a new skill or new task, I'm very detailed as to how things should be done. If I happen to hire someone with a low self-concept or a low self-image of themselves, the normal response I get from a person like this is, well, I can never do anything right for you. You're never happy with what I do. You're so picky. Or are they right? Well, essentially, maybe yes, they are. But if the person had a better self-image of themselves and strive for the same level of excellence as I do, they would perceive things differently. Their attitude is completely opposite from the previous person. They perceive, due to their positive self-concept, that I am not picking at them, but I'm working toward excellence. Another way to illustrate this would be to imagine for a moment that I'm an ice skater and you're a coach. Now, I skate a routine in practice, and then I fall. You approach me, and you tell me that the reason I fell was that I moved my left leg out about 3 inches too much, and I should have kept it tighter to my other leg. Now, what would you think if I said to you, man, you are really picky, 3 lousy inches? You're cutting me down for 3 inches? You're just overboard. You would think about coaching someone else, wouldn't you? What should my attitude be? 3 inches, wow, I didn't realize that. Let me go out there and try it again till I get this mastered. See, there's a big difference with those attitudes, aren't there? So negative self-concepts inhibit the perceptual processes by introducing psychological barriers which tend to keep the student from perceiving things in a more positive or a constructive manner. They may also inhibit the ability to properly implement that which is perceived. What does that mean? Well, they affect unfavorably the ability to do or perform tasks effectively. Learners who view themselves positively, on the other hand, they are less defensive and more attentive or eager to digest experiences by assimilating all of the instructions and demonstrations that are offered. The next factor that we're going to discuss which affect our perception is the fact that it takes time and opportunity to perceive. Yes, learning some things depends on other perceptions which have preceded these learnings and on the availability of time to sense and relate these new things to the earlier perceptions. Thus, sequence and time are really necessary. In general, lengthening an experience and increasing its frequency are the most obvious ways to faster learning, although this is not always effective. Many factors, in addition to the length and frequency of training periods, affect the rate of learning. The effectiveness of the use of a properly planned training syllabus or study guide is proportional to the consideration it gives to the time and opportunity factor in perception. Our last segment on the factors which affect perception is the recognition of the element of threat. See, fear adversely affects students' perceptions by narrowing their perceptual field. When confronted with threats, students tend to limit their attention to the perceived threatening object or condition. See, their field of vision is really reduced. For example, when an individual is threatened, All the perceptual faculties are focused on the thing that has generated the fear. That's all they focus on. Tunnel vision. Learning is a psychological problem when you think about it. It's not a logical one. Trying to frighten a student through threats of unsatisfactory reports or reprisals, well, it may seem logical, but it's not effective psychologically. See, the effective instructor can organize teaching to fit the psychology of the learner. If a situation seems overwhelming and the student feels capable of coping with the situation, then each new experience is viewed as a challenge. Realizing that behavior is a function of the way in which the individual perceives, and knowing that perceptions are affected by any and all of these factors, enables a good instructor to facilitate the learning process by avoiding any actions which prevent the attainment of teaching goals. Yes, teaching is consistently effective only when those factors which influence perceptions are recognized and taken into account. We've talked about how people learn through perceptions. Now we're going to discuss how we learn through insights. Insights involve the grouping of perceptions into meaningful wholes. Evoking these insights is the instructor's or teacher's responsibility. Now, to assure that these do occur, it is essential to keep each student constantly receptive to new experiences and to help the student realize the way each piece relates to all other pieces of the total pattern of the task to be learned. Now, insights will almost always occur eventually, whether or not instruction is provided. For this reason, it is possible for a person to become effective at a task by trial and error, just as one may be able to become a lawyer by reading law. But instruction, however, speeds this learning process by teaching the relationship of perceptions as they occur, thus promoting the development of insights by the student. As perceptions increase in number and are assembled by the student into larger blocks of learning to become insights, learning becomes more meaningful and more permanent. Forgetting is less of a problem and obviously more permanent. Now, forgetting too is less of a problem when there are more anchor points to which one can tie insights. It is a major responsibility of the instructor to organize demonstrations and explanations and to direct student practice so that the learner has better opportunities to understand the interrelationship of the many kinds of experiences that have been perceived. Motivation is the last of the three topics we'll discuss under how people learn. Motivation is probably the dominant force that governs a student's progress and ability to learn. It also may be negative or positive. It may be tangible, in other words, something you could see, feel, or touch, or intangible. They may be subtle and difficult to identify, or they may be very obvious. And negative motivations are those that may engender fears and be accepted by the student as a threat. While they have their uses in certain situations, they really aren't characteristically as effective in promoting efficient learning as are positive motivations. And positive motivations are provided by the promise or achievement of rewards. It's kind of like the carrot in front of you there. These rewards may be personal or social. They may involve financial gain, satisfaction of the self-concept, or public recognition. Some motivations that an instructor can take advantage of include the desire for personal gain, the desire for personal comfort or security, the desire for group approval, and the achievement of a favorable self-image or sense of achievement. Now, this is a good point to keep in mind from both the instructor and student's viewpoint. If, as humans, our motivations include the desire for personal gain, the desire for personal comfort or security, and the desire for group approval and the achievement of a favorable self-image or sense of achievement, that means this is what pushes our buttons. So to be an effective teacher or instructor, we need to know what specifically motivates the person we're trying to teach. Are they motivated by personal gain? Is it the desire for personal comfort or security, the desire for group approval, and so on? By studying this, if you will, you specifically know what buttons to push to best keep your student motivated. The more motivated he or she is, the more they'll usually be willing to learn and will learn. Now, on the other hand, if you are the one learning or the one being taught, my question to you is, what pushes your buttons for a specific task that you're trying to learn? Are you being motivated by personal gain? Is it the desire for personal comfort or security? The desire for group approval? See, you need to know that answer. It would be like having a car with 10 gas caps and only one of those caps open up to the opening for fuel to get the gas in the tank. If you wanted to keep fueling or motivating your vehicle, you need to know specifically which gas cap to uncover to fuel the car. Now, once you're able to determine what that is, your next objective is to constantly keep it what? That's right, constantly keep it fueled. The desire for personal gain, either the acquisition of things or a position, is a basic motivation for all human endeavor. An individual may be motivated to dig a ditch or to design a supersonic airplane solely by the desire for financial gain. Now, students are like all other workers in wanting a tangible return for their efforts. If such motivation is to be effective, they must believe that their efforts will be suitably rewarded. These rewards must be constantly apparent to the student during instruction, whether they are to be financial, self-interest, or public recognition. In other words, we always want to keep that carrot in front of us. You know, many lessons with objectives which are not obvious will pay off well during later instruction, but the student may not appreciate this fact in the beginning. It is important for the instructor to make the student aware of those applications which are not immediately apparent if we're going to help them maintain their motivation. Likewise, the devotion of much time and effort to drill and practice on operations will not directly contribute to competent performance, and that should be avoided. The desire for personal comfort and security is a motivation which is often inadequately appreciated by instructors. See, all students want secure, pleasant conditions and states of being. If they recognize that what they are learning may promote this objective, their interest is easier to attract and hold. Now, the contrary is insecure and unpleasant training situations retard learning. Everyone wants to avoid pain and injury. Students are likely to learn actions and operations which they realize may prevent injury or loss of life. This is especially true when the student knows the ability to make quick decisions or to act correctly in an emergency results from adequate learning. The attractive features of the activity to be learned can provide a powerful motivation. Students are anxious to learn skills which may be used to their advantage. If they can be made to understand that each learning task to which they are directed will be useful in preparing for the activities for which they undertook training, they will be eager to pursue it. Again, this is the teacher's job. The quicker you figure that out, the more effective you will be as a teacher. Group approval is a strong motivating force. Most every person wants the approval of at least friends and superiors. Interest can be stimulated and maintained by building on this natural force or desire. See, most students enjoy the feeling of belonging to a group and are interested in attaining an accomplishment which will give them prestige among their fellow students. Now, every person seeks to establish a favorable self-image. In certain instances, this self-image can be submerged in a feeling of insecurity or despondency. Fortunately for many, there is within each person engaged in the task the belief that success is possible under the proper combination of circumstances. This belief can be a most powerful motivating force for most students. This motivation can best be fostered by the instructor through the introduction of perceptions which are solely based on facts previously learned and which are easily recognized by the student as achievements in learning. Each additional block of learning toward the insight to be developed and toward the ultimate goal contributes to the confirmation within the student of a favorable image. As this confirmation progresses and confidence is achieved, advances will be more rapid and motivation will be strengthened as a result. So positive motivation is essential to true learning. Negative motivations in the form of reproof and threats should really be avoided with all but maybe the most overconfident and impulsive students. Sometimes you gotta knock them down mentally to let them realize that, hey, you know, don't get on your high horse there. Now, slumps in learning are often due to slumps in motivation. Motivation does not remain at a uniformly high level and may be affected by outside influences such as physical or mental disturbances or inadequate instruction. The instructor must tailor instruction to the maintenance of the highest level possible of motivation and should be alert to detect and counter relapses in motivation. When you as an instructor are able to do that with a student, then it can be said you really are a master teacher. Now let's talk about levels of learning. There are four levels of learning that we're now going to go over. The first is rote, R-O-T-E. After that is understanding. Next is application. And finally, correlation. Learning may be accomplished at any of these levels. Now, the lowest level is rote learning. It's basically the ability to repeat back something which someone has taught without understanding or being able to apply what is being learned. Progressively higher levels of learning are understanding what has been taught, achieving the skill to apply what has been learned and to perform correctly, and associating and correlating what has been learned with other things previously learned or subsequently encountered. For example, let's say that I'm a flight instructor and I'm going to teach you something about how to effectively turn an airplane while flying. So I say, you enter a turn by banking the airplane with aileron controls and applying sufficient rudder in the same direction to prevent slipping and skidding. Now, if I ask you what I said, you could, after a few minutes, memorize this information. In other words, as a student, you can repeat this instruction that you've heard and learned by rote, just by memory. This will never be very useful if you really had the opportunity or needed the opportunity to turn an airplane in flight because you have no knowledge of the function of the airplane controls. Now, with proper instruction on the effect and the use of flight controls, and experience under your belt, you as a student can develop these old and new perceptions into an insight as to how now you can make a turn. At this point, you as a student have developed understanding of the procedure by turning the airplane in flight. See, this understanding is basic to effective training, but may not necessarily enable the student to make a correct turn on the first attempt. When the student understands the procedure for entering a turn, has had turns demonstrated, and has practiced turn entries until consistency has been achieved in an acceptable performance for those entries, the student has developed the skill to apply what has been taught. This is a major level of learning, and one at which the instructor is too often willing to stop. Discontinuing instruction on turn entries at this point and directing subsequent instruction exclusively to other elements of piloting performance is characteristic of piecemeal instruction, which is usually ineffective. It violates the building block concept of instruction by failing to apply what has been learned to future learning tasks. Now, the highest level of learning, which should be the objective of all instruction, is that level at which the student becomes able to associate an element which has been learned with other segments or blocks of learning or accomplishment. The other segments may be items or skills previously learned or new learning tasks to be undertaken in the future. The student who has achieved this level in learning in, let's say, these turn entries, for example, has developed the ability to correlate the elements of turn entries with the performance of such combined and complex piloting operations as those required for the performance of something more challenging. So don't forget the four levels of learning. There's rote, understanding, then the application of what's understood, and finally the aha, the correlation. Now we're going to talk about learning skills. Even though the process of learning has many aspects, the main objective or purpose of most instruction is usually the learning of a concept, a generalization, or a skill. The process of learning a skill appears to be much the same whether it is a motor skill, meaning something physical, or a mental skill. To provide a real illustration of motor learning, let's say I were to ask you to do the following exercise. Write the word learning 15 times with your right hand if you're left-handed, or with your left hand if you're right-handed. Now, as you're doing this, try to improve in the speed at which you accomplish this task and the quality of your writing. In completing a task such as this, you will find that there are several principles of motor learning that is involved and will be discussed as we continue. Physical skills involve more than muscles. See, the exercise that we just went over contains a practical example of the multifaceted character of learning. Now, it should be obvious that while a muscular sequence was being learned, other things were happening as well. The perception changed as the sequence became easier. Concepts of how to perform the skill were developed, and attitudes were changed. Now, let's take some time and talk about the desire to learn. You know, thinking back over their past experiences and learning to perform certain skills, students might be surprised at how much more readily they learned those skills that appealed to their own needs. Shorter initial learning time and more rapid progress in improving the skill normally occurred. Now, conversely, where the desire to learn or improve was missing, of course, little progress was made. You know, a person may read dozens of books a year, but the reading rate will not increase unless there is a deliberate intent to increase it. So in the preceding learning exercise that we did earlier with writing with the wrong hand, you remember that? It is unlikely that any improvement occurred unless there was a clear intent to improve. So to improve, one must not only recognize mistakes, but also make an effort to correct them. There's the key. So the person who lacks the desire to improve is not likely to make the effort and consequently will continue to practice errors. That's why you see the same people doing the same things over and over and over and over again. The skillful instructor relates the lesson objective to the student's intentions and their needs, and in doing so, builds on the student's natural enthusiasm. That takes an art to do. Now let's talk about patterns to follow. See, logically, the point has been emphasized that the best way to prepare the student to perform a task is to provide clear step-by-step example. Having a model to follow permits a student to get a clear picture of each step in the sequence, what it is, and how to do it. Students need to get a clear impression of what they are to do. You notice many times before a speaking engagement, what I do is I prep the audience. I let them know what they're going to expect today. I give them a pattern to follow. I give them a clear picture, and I want them to know what it is and what they're going to get from it. The next thing to consider now is to perform the skill. Now, since you've now experienced writing a word with the wrong hand, consider how difficult it would be to tell someone how to do it. Even demonstrating how to do it would not result in that person's learning the skill. So obviously, what's necessary? Practice, practice, practice. Yes, practice is necessary. The student needs to coordinate between the muscles and the visual and all these different senses to make things work. Learning to perform various motor skills require this type of practice. Now, there's another benefit of practice. As a student gains proficiency in a skill, verbal instructions mean even more. Whereas a long, detailed explanation gets confusing before the student begins performing. Specific comments are more meaningful now and useful after the skill has been partially mastered. A typical example of this is if I'm doing a seminar and at the seminar I happen to do my phobia reversal. This is where I take a person who's incredibly phobic and without hypnosis, I reprogram, for a lack of a better word, or reconstruct their thought process to show the audience how quick the human mind can change and what we're capable of doing. So somebody is observing this from the audience, and because of this, they've now chosen to hire me. Their knowledge or their understanding is limited at this point. Once I work with them, what happens now, I give them skills, I give them things to do, and their depth of understanding is so much greater. Now, the next time they go to another seminar of mine, they can understand so much more than the person sitting next to them because they've taken some of these skills, they've practiced them, now they're watching the seminar again, and they have a whole new meaning and a whole new perception compared to everybody else in the audience because they've got skills and they've taken these skills and these experiences and they've put them into practice. Now let's talk about knowledge of results. In learning some simple skills, students can discover their own errors quite easily. Sometimes the learner may know that something is wrong, but may not know how to correct it. I think all of us have experienced that from time to time. In any case, the instructor provides a helpful and often critical function in making certain that the students are aware of their progress. It is perhaps as important for students to know when they are right as when they are wrong, wouldn't you agree? They should be told as soon after the performance as possible because if not, they're going to be allowed to make the same mistake and they're going to actually practice making the mistake. Remember, it is more difficult to unlearn a mistake and then learn it correctly than to learn correctly in the first place. Now, one way to make students aware of their progress is to repeat a demonstration or example to show them the standard against which they can compare their performance. Now, let's talk about progress in following a pattern. See, the experience of learning to write a word with the wrong hand probably confirmed what has been consistently demonstrated in laboratory experiments on skill learning. The first trials are slow, and coordination obviously is going to be lacking. Mistakes will be frequent, but each trial provides clues for improvement in subsequent trials. So the learner modifies different aspects of the skill, how to hold the pencil, how to execute the finger and the hand movements and so forth, till they get to the point that they get to mastering it. Think of it in terms of a graph. Graphs of the progress of learning skills usually follow the same pattern. There's a rapid improvement in the early trials, then the curve levels off and may stay level for significant periods of effort. Further improvement may seem unlikely. Such a development is a learning plateau and may signify a number of conditions. For example, the learner may have reached capability limits, maybe consolidating level of skills, or their interest has died down, or the learner may need a more effective method of increasing progress. So keep in mind that the apparent lack of increasing proficiency does not necessarily mean that learning has ceased. The point is that in learning motor skills, many times there's a leveling off process or a plateau, and that's normal, and it should be expected after an initial period of rapid improvement. See, the instructor here, though, should really prepare the student for this situation to avert discouragement. If the student is aware of this learning plateau, frustration may be lessened. I know that's one of the things that I mention to each one of my students. As I spend time with them, I let them know before I hang up, yes, be prepared for a little bit of regression. Be prepared that things are going to go very well for a while, and all of a sudden, you're going to stop and say, oh, what do I do now? Or maybe you'll regress a little bit. And if you tell somebody that, they can expect it, and it will prevent them from being so frustrated. Another important point to remember is the duration of a lesson. See, in planning for a student's performance, a primary consideration really should be the length of time that's devoted to practice. Now, a beginning student reaches a point where additional practice is not only unproductive, but it may even be harmful. For example, if a student gets to the point that they can't really assimilate any more knowledge or information or skills, they're going to keep practicing the same thing over and over again in the wrong way, especially if you bombard them with more information. So at this point, the student is really going to get to the point where his errors are going to increase, and if you're not careful, their motivation is certainly going to decline. So as a student gains experience, longer periods of practice are more profitable. Now another consideration is the problem of whether to divide the practice period and perhaps the instruction maybe into segments, or whether to plan some one-on-one continuous work or maybe some type of integrated sequences. Now, the answer is going to depend on the nature of the skill. Some skills are composed of closely related steps, each dependent on the preceding one. For example, maybe learning to pack a parachute. You know, it's step by step by step has to be done right. Other skills are composed of related subgroups of skills. For example, learning to overhaul an engine or maybe to sew a dress. Let's go back to that handwriting demonstration that we did earlier. So we're going to talk now about evaluation versus critique. If an instructor were to evaluate the last or the 15th writing of the word learning, only limited help could be given toward further improvement. When you stop and think about it, the instructor could judge whether the written word was legible and evaluate against some type of a standard or a criteria, or perhaps even assign it a grade of some sort. But none of these actions would be particularly useful to a beginning student. However, the student could profit by having someone watch the performance and critique it constructively to help them eliminate errors. So, in the initial stages, practical suggestions are more valuable to the student than a grade. Early evaluation is usually teacher-oriented. It provides a check on teaching effectiveness, it can be used to predict eventual student learning proficiency, and it can help the teacher locate specific or special problem areas. So the observation on which the evaluations are based can also identify the student's strengths and weaknesses, which is important for making constructive criticism. Now let's go over the application of skill. The final and critical problem here is use. Can the student use what's been learned? It's not uncommon to find that students devote weeks and even months in school learning new abilities and then failed to apply these abilities on the job. I think we've all experienced that. Maybe you went to school and you took pre-algebra or algebra or calculus, The average person does not use that in the real world. So to solve the problem, two conditions must be present. Number one, the student must learn the skill so well that it becomes easy, even habitual, to perform it. And the second, number two, the student must recognize the types of situations where it's appropriate to use the skill. The second condition involves the question of transfer of learning, which I'll be discussing later on. Let's take some time now to talk about forgetting and retention. Our first subtitle on the segment will be Theories of Forgetting. A consideration of why people forget may point the way to helping them remember. Several theories account for forgetting. The first, disuse. You know, it's been long argued that a person forgets those things which are not used. The high school or college graduate is saddened by the small amount of factual data retained several years after graduation. Since the things which are remembered are those used on the job, a person concludes that forgetting is a result of disuse. But the explanation is not quite so simple. Experimental studies show, for example, that a hypnotized person can describe specific details of an event which would normally be beyond recall. Apparently, the memory is there, locked in the recesses of the mind. The difficulty is summoning it up to the consciousness when you want it. Interference is the next one. One theory holds that people forget a thing because a certain experience has overshadowed it, or that the learning of similar things has intervened. This theory might explain how the range of experiences after graduation from school causes a person to lose knowledge. In other words, new events displace many things that have been learned. From experiments, two conclusions about interference may be drawn. Here's the both of them. Number one, closely similar material seem to interfere with memory more than dissimilar material. And the second, material not well learned suffers most from interference. The third theory that might account for forgetting is repression. Now, Freudian psychology advances the view that some forgetting is due to the submersion of ideas into the unconscious mind. Material that is unpleasant or produces anxiety may be treated this way by the individual, but not intentionally. It is subconscious and protective. The repression theory does not appear to account for much forgetfulness of the kind discussed in this segment, but it does tend to explain some cases. Our next area of discussion is retention of learning. Now, each of the theories that we just went over implies that when a person forgets something, it is not actually lost, rather it is unavailable for recall. Now, the instructor's challenge here, then, is how to make certain that the student's learning is always available for recall. So here are some suggestions that might help. Additional to the following suggestions, I strongly encourage you to get my Ultimate Guide to Memory Control program that is available online at GaryCox.com. To make the information we teach someone more memorable, we must teach thoroughly and with meaning. Material thoroughly learned is highly resistant to forgetting. This is suggested by experimental studies. It also is pointed out in our discussions on skill learning. Now, meaningful learning builds patterns of relationships in the student's consciousness, whereas rote learning is superficial and it is not easily retained. Meaningful learning goes deep, because it involves principles and concepts anchored in the student's own experience. That's the difference between that and just rote learning. Now, the following are five significant principles which are generally accepted as having a direct application to remembering. Number one, praise stimulates remembering. Responses which give a pleasurable return tend to be repeated. So then, absence of praise or recognition tends to discourage one, and any form of negativity in the acceptance of a response tends to make its recall less likely. Now, the second one is recall is promoted by association. Each bit of information or action which is associated with something to be learned tends to facilitate its later recall by the student. Unique or disassociated facts tend to be forgotten unless they are of special interest or application. The next one is favorable attitudes aid retention. People learn and remember only what they wish to know. Without motivation, there is little chance for recall. The most effective motivations are those based on positive or rewarding objectives. Now, some people say, oh, my memory is terrible and bad and all that. Now, if I said to you, I want you to remember my phone number, and maybe you say, oh, wait, I got to write it down. But if I said to you, okay, I'm going to give you $1 million if you call me tomorrow at 12 o'clock. Here's my phone number. You can't write it down. Do you think you're going to remember it? And do you think you're going to remember to call me on time? Absolutely. The next thing is, learning with all our senses is most effective. Although we generally receive what we learn through our eyes and our ears, other senses also contribute to our perceptions. When several senses respond together, fuller understanding and greater chance of recall is going to be achieved. Now, the last one is meaningful repetition aids recall. Each repetition gives the student an opportunity to gain a clearer and more accurate perception of the subject to be learned, but mere repetition does not guarantee retention, does it? Practice gives an opportunity for learning, but does not cause it. Further, it is also believed that 3 or 4 repetitions provide the maximum effect, after which the rate of learning and probability of retention fall off rapidly.